Chapter 17, By All That's Holy. There's a back alley between the tenement buildings. You can't see it from the road, and Iggy takes us along the alley to this other place. You can tell how the door has been busted in and the lock broke, and we go into the dark hallway. The lights come on, and the first thing I notice is the perfume an old lady wears and the smell of cats. It ain't much, but the old bat who lives here took a greyhound to visit his sister for the holiday, Iggy says. He's trying to smile. The little room is warm and close-feeling, and the furniture is real old and saggy. There's a big old TV with a doily on the top, and an empty goldfish bowl, and piles of newspapers tied up neat with string, and a Bible on this little table by the TV. Also, there's this trick picture of Jesus on the wall, where his eyes keep following you, and you go cross-eyed looking at it. Ain't much worth taking, Iggy says. My father is looking around, making sure the curtains are closed. You think I'd steal from an old woman, he says. Iggy shakes his head. I sure don't. Never you mind, my father says. This will do in a pinch, until we get started. I better get back to Loretta. You do that. My father watches the door shut behind Iggy, and he doesn't say anything. I'm just standing there in the middle of the room, because I don't know what he wants me to do. Make yourself comfy, boy, he finally says. I'm going to check we have a back way out. I'm looking at the door we came in by, just looking, when all of a sudden he's there behind me. And I feel the cool air of him on the back of my neck. You wouldn't light out on me now, would you? No, sir, I wouldn't. Sit down, he says. We need to talk, man to man. I sit down in this old lady chair, that's so soft I almost sink through to the floor, and I'm wondering what happened to the cats. Maybe she took them with her, to visit her sister. Or maybe Iggy let them out and they can't get back in. He leans over me and puts his big hands on the arms of the chair, and he says, Now, your grandparents say you're nothing but a dysfunctional retard, but no kin of mine is a retard, and that's a fact. So first thing, you gotta start acting smart. Use your head. We've got a situation going here, boy. So the way to handle it, you just do exactly what I say, no matter what. Understood? Yes, sir. His hand shoves through my hair, and I can feel how strong he is, even though he doesn't hurt me. That's good, he says. That's real good. He goes into another room, and I can hear a door banging and stuff being moved around, and when he comes back, he's got this rope in his hands. A boy who doesn't know his own father might be dumb enough to run away, he says. We can't have that, can we? No, sir. No, sir, what? No, sir, we can't have that. What he does is tie up my feet and hands, then he loops the end of the rope around his waist. I'm taking sack time while I can, he says. You're as smart as I think you are. You'll get some shut-eye, too. He turns out the light and lies down on the floor beside the chair, with just his arm for a pillow, and for a long time I can't tell whether he's asleep or pretending. Then I decide it doesn't matter. If I move, the rope will surely wake him. It seems like we're frozen inside that room, even though the air is warm and stuffy. The soft chair keeps a hold of me. I'm not strong enough to get up. My feet and hands are getting tingly where they're tied, and pretty soon I can't even keep my eyes open. I'm half asleep, dreaming a cat is in the other room, mewing for milk, and I'm still thinking about the cat when something tugs me. He's sitting there in the dark, so I can't see his face, and he says, Wake up, sleepyhead. I better tell my own son a thing or two he needs to know about his own father. First thing, like I already said, I never killed anybody. I'm big like you're big, so folks assume things they shouldn't. You understand what I'm saying? Yes, sir, I do. Good. Now, the other thing is, the geezers you've been living with all these years, I bet they never gave you the presents I sent you. Did they? No, sir, they didn't. He shakes his head real sorrowful. That's a crime, not giving a boy presents from his father. I suppose you didn't get the letters I sent. No, if they didn't give over the presents, they likely tore up the letters. Another crime against humanity. That's what that is. They hated me from the first sight, on account of my appearance, and because I wasn't good enough for their precious daughter. As if a man should be blamed for how fearsome or cruel he looks, when in fact he's truly a loving person inside, which I am. I can hardly see a sad movie without crying, and I'm not afraid to say so. There's just enough streetlight coming through the curtains so I can make out part of his face when he turns it. You can see where there's a wet spot on his cheek, and he brushes it away. I've been locked up like an animal, he says. Every single night, I cried myself to sleep, and that's a fact. Killer Kane, That's just an unkind nickname that hung on me. You know how kids can be mean in school. Mean as animals. It was like that, only these weren't kids. They were adults who should know better. Except they're so ignorant and hateful, they believe the worst. His voice is sort of ragged, but you can't help but listen to him. You follow the words up and down, like you're riding through mountains, and you can't see to either side. All you can see is the road just ahead. A great injustice was done to me, boy, he says. What those people did, they stole my life. They took years away from me. Might as well have cut my heart out with a knife. That's how it was to lie awake each night and think about the injustice was done to me. They'd blame me for all the wrongs in the world, those people. By which I mean the geezers, her folks, that always hated me. And of course the police who failed to see the truth of the situation. He stops to rub away another stream of tears. There's no crying in his voice. You can't hear it there. But sure enough, the tears are all over his face, slick and shiny in the pale, pale light. I woke up just now, worrying that you might wonder why I never did mention her. Your mother. You might still be thinking the wrong way on that, and believe what they told you. You being such a tiny little thing when it happened. How could you know the truth of it? He gets up then, and he goes over by the TV set, far enough so the rope is tugging at me. Then he's back. And he's got a book in his hands. You know what this is, boy? The Bible, I say. You can tell that in the dark, can you? That's fine. What I'm going to do, I'm putting my right hand down on this Bible, see? Yes, sir, I see. And I'm putting my other hand over my heart. Can you see that? Yes, sir, I can. That's good, boy. Now listen up. I, Kenneth David Kane, do swear by all that's holy, that I did not murder this boy's mother. And if that isn't the truth, may God strike me dead. I'm waiting to see if something happens, and nothing does. The room is the same. It smells of old lady perfume and missing cats, and my hands and feet are still tied by a rope to his waist. Satisfied? He says. I want to answer him, but my throat closes up, and my tongue is so dry I can hardly open my mouth. I keep thinking about how heavy his hand was on that Bible. I asked you a question, boy. Yes, sir, I say. I'm satisfied. He lies back down after that, and pretty soon he's breathing heavy again. I can't sleep, though. I just sit there, like a lump, until the sun comes up, trying not to think about the things I didn't want to remember. Chapter 18. Never Trust a Cripple. I'm waiting for something to happen. The whole world except me is asleep, and the only sound is him breathing heavy. I'm trying to see through the curtains, out the old lady's window, when it finally gets light, but the snow is stuck to the glass and everything is fuzzy, which is pretty much how I feel. Looking down at him on the floor, how he overflows the rug, I think about the story where a giant falls asleep and is tied up by little people. Not that I do anything. I'm just a blob in the chair, with numb hands and numb feet. Finally what happens, there's a noise from the back and these light skittery footsteps, and then my father comes awake so fast he almost yanks me from the chair. He's on his feet with this wild look in his eye, and Loretta Lee glides into the room. Merry Christmas, boys, she says. She's got this pizza box in her hands, holding it out like a present. Where's Iggy? My father asks. Waiting for Santa Claus, Loretta says. Ain't nothing open this morning. But we got this left over. You're welcome to it. Best put that down, he says, and he pulls on the rope and lifts me up. He gives her this cold look. You go on and get Iggy, he says. Loretta Lee is wearing this long winter coat. It looks clean and brand new, so she probably got it for Christmas. But her legs are skinny and bare, where her feet go into these old rubber boots. She's smoking this cigarette and squinting through the smoke at my father, like she's trying to figure out what he's thinking. Why can't you be nice, Kenny? She says. We had some good times in the old days, remember? The old days are over, he says. That the best you can do for us, leftover pizza? Hey, pizza is good for you, she says. It has vitamins and stuff. I still want to see Iggy. Loretta takes a drag on her cigarette, and she's got this crooked smile. Her eyes keep flicking at me, and the way I'm roped up, but mostly she's looking at him. Iggy'll be up soon, she says. He had himself a tough night. I have business with him, Loretta, he says. Important business. I'm sure, she says, and she turns in her boots and leaves through the back. The pizza box is sitting there on the table, but my father says we can't eat anything touched by our dirty hands. So he walks me out into that dark little kitchen, and he unties me, and we go through the cupboards and find mostly boxes of prunes and old cereal. There's nothing in the refrigerator that hasn't already gone bad, so I eat a bowl of cornflakes with water, and I'm so hungry it almost tastes good. This is what they call a temporary situation, he says. I know a way we can live like kings if we play our cards right. He stops for a while and squints at me, like he wants to see inside my head. We'll be heading for warmer weather. That agreeable with you, boy? Yes, sir, it is. He seems real thoughtful. I had a lot of time to plan this out. A lot of time to study people, figure what makes them tick. First thing, we'll get a bus. One of those RV things, a real big one, because it's important to look impressive. Put a name up on the side. The Reverend Kenneth David Kane. Or it might be well go with another name, just to be on the safe side. Did you guess I was a man of God, boy? Could you tell that by looking at me? Yes, sir, I say. I mean, no, sir. What's that mean, boy? I don't know, sir. He reaches out and tussles at my hair. You'll learn, he says. You'll be standing out in front of the bus in a real nice suit. What you do is collect money in a basket. You won't have to steal it, because folks will give to a man of God, and what they love to hear about is a bad man who has redeemed himself. I learned how to preach the word to a lot of illiterate convicts, but they were no more ignorant than a lot of other folk. No, sir, we're going to do just fine. After I finish the cornflakes, he ties me up again. This is just a precaution, he says. Can't take any chances until you see the light. You want to see the light? Yes, sir, I do. He's grinning at me, and he taps himself on the chest and says, You're looking at it, boy. I am the light, and don't you ever forget it. He turns on the TV. It hardly comes in at all. The screen is so fuzzy. And he keeps switching channels, and he's cussing out the old lady for having such a crummy TV. All that's on is Christmas stuff and cartoons, and what he wants is the news, to see if we're on it. I bet they haven't even missed you, he says. Kept you down in that cellar like an animal. How would they know? We're sitting there, waiting for Iggy, when the blue lights start flashing bright against the curtains. He quick grabs me by the neck and shoves me down the floor, and we both lie there. The blue lights go by real slow. You can see them shining all around the room. Might be someone else they're looking for, he says. A place like this, it could be anybody. Still, you can't be too careful. When the lights stop flashing, he crawls to the window and looks out. There's nothing dumber than a dumb cop, he says. If they were so smart, they wouldn't be working on Christmas Day, would they? No, sir, I say. You hush up, boy, and let me think. I'm lying there on the floor tied up when Iggy sneaks in through the back. I know it's him by the draggy way he walks and the heavy boots. Kenny, he's whispering. You there? Of course I'm here, he says. Show yourself. Iggy comes into the room and his eyes are darting around. At first he's surprised to see me trussed up. Then he shrugs and doesn't look at me anymore. Close call, he says. You see that cop car? I saw it. They come right up to my door looking for the boy, he says. I said, come back with a search warrant. You want to see what I keep under my bed? But I let him have a good look from the door, satisfy him you weren't there. They believe you? Who knows with cops? Then my father is sort of drooping his arm around Iggy and giving him a squeeze, and you can see the cold, scared look in Iggy's little eyes and that wet mouth of his inside his beard. You turn on me, did you? My father says. That how they just happened to come to your place? Of all the places in this town? Iggy laughs real nervous. It was that crippled midget kid, he says. They had him out in the car. It must have been him. Loretta saw him peeking up over the seat. Freak. What midget kid? My father asks. You think I'll fall for that? Iggy points at me and says, Ask him does he have a midget friend. The two of them stole Loretta's purse. That's how come they know this place. That's the God's honest truth, Kenny. My father kneels down and looks at me up close. His face doesn't show anything. Well, he says, what's your story? We didn't steal it, I say. We just brought it back. Oh, my father says, now that's an interesting story. I like that story. Iggy is talking fast, like he can't wait to get rid of the words and leave. The crippled up kid belongs to Gwen. Remember Gwen? Her and your wife were pals. That's what Loretta says. My father puts his hand on Iggy and shoves him down in the old lady's chair. Never mind about her. It doesn't matter how the cops got onto you. All that matters is they did. And now what are we going to do about it? Iggy is scratching at his beard, and he starts to say something. And my father says, "Shut up and let me think." Iggy shuts up. Every now and then, he sneaks a look at me, like he's trying to tell me something, with his eyes. But I can't figure out what. After a while, my father says, "First thing, get me a firearm. Something small but functional. Next thing is transportation. I don't care what, as long as it runs. Can you do that for me?" Iggy says he can. No problem. "Then do it," my father says. "The quicker the better." Iggy leaves, walking backward out of the room. My father lifts me up by the rope and says, "I know you have more sense than to waste your time stealing pocketbooks with a cripple kid. You can't trust a cripple. But I guess you know that now, don't you?" He shakes the rope. "Yes, sir, I do." Chapter 19. Into the Black Down Under. We have to leave the old lady's place, because you never know. The cops might come knocking on each door. They're like bugs, my father says. They're not too smart, but there's lots of them, and they keep at it. On the other side of the alley is this boarded-up building. It used to be part of the Testaments until a fire burned it out, and my father decides we'll hide in there until Iggy gets a car for us. He reaches out and pulls off a big piece of plywood with one hand. The screechy noise the nails make sounds like a cat fight, and the next thing there's a real cat, a black one, that leaps out from behind the plywood. My father jumps so hard, he yanks me to the ground and I bump my head. "Dumb animal," he says. "Get up now. That's just a scratch. A little blood never hurt a man." It doesn't hurt, and anyhow, I sort of like the taste of salt in my mouth. It makes me feel awake. "Get in there," he says, and then he's pulling me through this old burned-out window, and we're inside the building. Everything is black and wet and dripping, except for where snow has come down through the holes in the roof. Most of the inside walls are gone, and you can see where the center beam was chewed by the fire. All the old pipes and wires are hanging down, and everywhere underfoot is broken glass, the color of smoke. "I used to wonder exactly what hell looked like," he says. "Now I know." He finds a place where the stairs go down into the basement, and he pulls away the boards and planks. "You should feel right at home," he says, "cooped up like you were in that cellar hole." It's so dark he has to use a cigarette lighter, and the flame is so puny, you still can't see to the bottom of the stairs. "You go first," he says. "We can't have both of us on the same step. It might break." The steps are made of thick wood, but slick and punky soft, where the water has been dripping all these years, and I can feel how it sags under my feet. There's a rail that's hard to grab with my hands tied. And the way he's holding up the lighter, you might as well keep your eyes closed, because it's that dark. You can't see a thing. I slip and start to fall, and then he's pulling back on the rope, and I'm hanging there in the middle of the air with my feet skittering as he's going, "Easy does it, boy. We'll take this one step at a time." Finally, we get to the bottom. There's a little slant of light coming through this narrow cellar window, enough so we can feel our way around all the burn junk that has fallen through the floor. "The accommodations could be better," he says. "I'll grant you that. Soon as Iggy fixes things, we'll be on our way." He ties my feet back up and loops the rope tight around this old busted-up boiler that's tipped over, so I can't move or see what's behind me. "Understand you can't be trusted quite yet," he says. "Once we get on the road, things will be different. You'll get smarter every mile we put between us and this place." He rips a piece off my shirt and ties it on my mouth so I can't be shouting, he says, and wake up the neighborhood. He rubs his hand through my hair again, real gentle. I'm pretty sure there's a sweet smile on his face, although it's so dim, you can't be sure. "You just sit tight here a minute," he says. "I have to see a man about a car." Then he's gliding away, and I hold myself still in case this is a trick and he's really sneaking up behind me to see if I can get my hands loose, which I can't. They're numb and bloated from the rope cutting into my wrists. And finally I stop trying and just sit there, letting my eyes open in the dark. I can barely make out the narrow window, hardly big enough so a cat could slip through, and under it is this big pile of coal, slagged up against the foundation wall. Overhead there's creaking, with the weight of him moving around, trying to be light on his feet. I'm listening to him up there and trying to see out the little window when something moves against the light. I'm pretty sure there's a scratching sound coming from the window. Except you can't always believe what you hear in the dark. Then whatever it is goes away, and I'm thinking it was probably a cat, or maybe a dog sniffing around. Finally, I just keep still, because the more I move, the tighter the rope gets. Next thing, I hear someone on the steps, these light feet, trying to be real quiet. And then a flashlight comes on, and this woman's voice says, "You there, kid?" Loretta Lee. I can't say anything because of the gag. All I can do is sort of kick around a little, let her know where I am. You can tell by her shaky, thin voice she's scared of the dark. "Kid, tell me that's you." Oh, Lord Jesus, what am I doing down here? Then the beam of the flashlight is hitting me right in the eyes, and she's tripping over stuff, trying to get to me. First thing she does is pull the gag off, and I take a deep, deep breath that makes my lungs burn. "It ain't right," she whispers, "keeping your own kid tied up. It ain't right. He ain't the man I thought I remembered, that's for sure." I want to say something, but I'm not sure what, and anyhow, my mouth is too dry. She's put the flashlight on the floor, aiming up, so she can try to untie the rope. "The man is a genius for knots," she says. I can feel how her hands are shaking as she's fumbling around. Also, I can hear the boards creaking overhead, but you can't be sure, it might be just the wind. Loretta goes, "The plan is, Iggy keeps him busy while I get you loose. Now isn't that a good plan? There's enough cops up there to start a war. We'll be safe enough if we get out of this godforsaken place." Her hands are pulling at the rope, nervous and quick, but the knots just keep getting tighter. Finally, she gets this idea to cut the rope on the ragged edge of the boiler. "I saw this in the movies once," she whispers. "I forget what movie." She's working the rope against the sharp edge of that old boiler, and sure enough, it cuts through. Just the one cut won't do it, though, and she has to do it twice more before my wrists get loose. And I can't really help much because my hands are all numb and swollen. "Next thing is this piece around your ankles," she says. "I sure can't carry you up out of here. You think you can walk if I get this loose?" "Yes, ma'am," I say. That makes her giggle. "My, ain't we got polite all of a sudden," she says. "There, that should about do it." My feet come loose and I try to stand up, and I have to lean some of my weight on her. She goes, "Just a second, sugar. Let me get this flashlight." She bends over for the flashlight, and then she's making the sound like something is caught in her throat. Two big hands are squeezing her neck. I see how my father is coming huge out of the dark, and he's got his hands around her throat, shoving her back. "You ignorant creature," he says. "I'll teach you to put your dirty hands on my son." Loretta can't say anything. She's sinking down to her knees and trying to pull his hands away from her neck, but it's useless. She can't stop him. He's squeezing her dead with his bare hands, and no one can stop him. No one. No one. Chapter 20. Freak the Mighty Strikes Again. Even a total goon like me knows you can't stop Killer Kane, but I go ahead and try anyhow. My hands are still numbed out, and I can hardly walk, so all I can do is sort of fall on top of him and try to shove him loose from her. I'm going, "Stop! I see you! I see you, Daddy! Please, please stop! You're killing her!" He just twitches me away. He's made of iron and steel. He's gritting his teeth and squeezing her neck. You can see the whites of her eyes, and she's not even trying to get away anymore. I try to get between them, and I'm going, "I saw you kill her. I saw you kill Mom. I never forgot. Not ever. I know you did it. I know." It's like I'm trapped underwater or something. So weak and floaty, I can't hardly fight him. Can't pry his fingers loose from my mother's neck. From Loretta's neck. Because everything is mixed up, and he's doing the same thing to Loretta Lee he did to my mom, choking the life out of her. And he's got the same cold killer look, because he wants her to die, like he wanted Mom to die. And nothing else matters, except what he wants. I'm there in the dark, pushing at him. The light catches her eyes, and I can see her looking at me. She's so far away, it's like I'm 4 years old again, peeking out from behind the bedroom door, and then running to bang my little fist at him, while the light fades from her eyes. I can't get him loose of her, so all I can do is keep screaming. "I know you killed her. I saw you. I saw you do it. You killed her, and I'll never forget. Not ever." Finally, he kind of jerks his head, and I can feel him looking at me. And then his hands open. Loretta slips away, and I can hear her breathing, like a broken bird in the cellar dark. "What?" he says, reaching for me. "What did you say?" "I saw you do it," I say. "I saw you kill my mother." "You weren't but 4 years old," he says. And now his big hands are starting to curl around my neck, except he's holding me soft. I can feel his heart beating, and his cool breath in my face that makes me want to fall asleep. "You can't possibly recall that event," he says. "You think you can, but you can't." "I can," I say. I do. That's the poison they put in your mind, boy. They brainwashed you into thinking you can remember. He's pulling me closer, holding me soft by the neck, and now I can feel the pulse in his hands. They never talk about it, I say. They don't have to, because I can't ever forget it, no matter how much I try. No, he says, and his face is so close I can feel the heat rising off him. Impossible, you can't. You're wearing your brown corduroy trousers, I say, talking so fast it makes me shake inside, and the black t-shirt with no sleeves. I tried to stop you, and I couldn't. And you carried me back to my room, and put me to bed, and you told me I was just dreaming. You locked me in that room, and I ran to the window and broke it with my hand, and started yelling for someone to come help Mommy. My father sighs and says, Lord, I wish you hadn't done that, boy. It cost me years. They caught you, Daddy. And they put you away forever. Except then you fooled them, and they let you go. I have to clean this up, he says, like he's talking to himself alone. I have to clean this up and get out of here. That's when his hands start to tighten hard and fast around my neck. I'm trying to fight him, but I'm so small and weak, and he's so big and strong. You can't stop him. No one can stop Killer Kane. He squeezes and squeezes and squeezes. I'm in this faraway place, falling backwards, real slow and dreamy, when I hear a window breaking. Then a small faraway voice is saying, Put your hands up, villain. And I really am falling, and the air is coming back into my lungs so fast it hurts. I'm lying there, all crumpled up sideways. I can see Freak. He's rolled down through the cellar window into the pile of coal, and he's trying to stand up. I'm warning you, he says in that fierce, bold way he has. He's got a squirt gun, one of those big blaster models that holds about a gallon of water. Killer Kane is looking at me. He's looking at Loretta, all crumpled and moaning. He's looking at Freak. Then he shakes his head and goes, I know a real gun when I see it, you little monster. He makes a move, reaching out. Freak scuttles back a little ways, but he can't really run, and even if he could, there's no place to go. This is your partner in crime, Killer Kane says to me. I guess maybe you are a retard after all. Freak is pointing the squirt gun right in his face, and he says, Guess what I got for Christmas, Mr. Kane. Guess right, because your life depends on it. Killer Kane doesn't say anything. He's just reaching out real slow because he knows that Freak can't get away. This squirt gun, Freak says, and a chemistry set. That's what I got for Christmas. Killer Kane just looks at the squirt gun. He shakes his head. Like, who are you kidding? Sulfuric acid, Freak says, raising up the gun and sighting along the barrel. Good old reliable H2SO4, an oily, colorless, corrosive liquid used in dyes, paints, explosives, and many chemical experiments. Killer Kane says, You're lying, kid. You can't fool me. That's when Freak squeezes the trigger and sprays him right in the eyes. Then Killer Kane is screaming in this high, scared voice. His hands are scrubbing at his eyes, and it's like that scream wakes me up, because the next thing I know, I've got Freak in my arms, and I'm running through the dark for the stairs, running as fast as I can, on feet I can't even feel. Go, Freak is yelling. He's right behind you. Go! I can't look back, but I can feel him. Feel the icy cold breath of him on the back of my neck, and the hands reaching blind to grab me, and then I'm going up the stairs, just flying. The steps are breaking under my feet, and he's howling in rage behind me. His hands are scrabbling at my ankles, and for just a second, he has me. I kick loose, and then we're up on the first floor, bursting out of the cellar hole. I can see daylight coming through the boarded up plywood, and I cover Freak with my arms and just dive right through the plywood. Wham! The sunlight blinds me, and we're skitter rolling through the clean, cold snow. Hands are grabbing at me, and I'm fighting to get away. Easy, a voice says. Take it easy, kid. You're okay. Iggy Lee. He's looking down at me with red eyes, and you can see where he's been chewing at his beard. I'm sitting there in the snow, squinting up at Iggy. And all these cops, there must be a million cops, and Freak is laughing like a maniac and saying, It worked. He fell for it. Soap and vinegar and curry powder. It worked like a charm. I don't understand what he's talking about right then. It's only later I figured out there wasn't any real acid in the squirt gun. It was soap and vinegar and curry powder that made Killer Kane think his eyes were burning up. Killer Kane, who was still rubbing frantic at his eyes and begging for help when they put the handcuffs on him and shove him into the back of a police van. All I've got room to think about is poor Loretta. That's what I'm telling the cops, that she's down there in the cellar. I'm afraid that no one is listening, but they must be, because right away, They're bringing her up out of the cellar, and Iggy is running to her and crying out her name. She's still breathing, somebody says. Then Grim is shoving through the crowd of cops, and Grim is right behind her, and Gwen is there too, and everybody is making a big sloppy fuss, especially Grim, who's hugging me so tight, I can't hardly breathe. The fair Gwen is hugging Freak, and she's saying, I told you to stay in that car, didn't I? Didn't I? Freak, he's looking over her shoulder at me, looking over Graham's shoulder, and he gives me the thumbs up as she carries him away. Freak the Mighty, he says. Freak the Mighty strikes again. Chapter 21, The Accident of Nature. We all of us had to go down to the police station, of course, where they took a bunch of pictures of the bruises on my neck. And then they insisted I needed x-rays, and so we had to go over to the hospital and get that done, and then go back to the police station again, which wore on my nerves almost as much as being kidnapped. Grim, the second time we go to the cops, he's sitting there in this room with me waiting, and he says, I can't tell you what it felt like, coming up out of the basement and seeing that double track of footprints in the snow. I knew it was him. I just knew in my heart. He kept insisting that Grim go home, which she finally did, because we were there at the police station for hours more, me telling all about it over and over, until I thought I would faint dead away if just one more person asked me what happened after I woke up in the dark and was stolen from my own bed. Grim, he just keeps patting me on the arm and saying, This is important, Max. Maybe this time they'll lock him up for good. That's what everybody keeps saying, that this time they've got Killer Kane where they want him, in violation of parole, in violation of restraining order, abduction of a minor, and 2 counts of attempted murder. Me and the heroic biker babe, which is what the papers took to calling Loretta Lee. The word is she's hurt pretty bad because he cracked a bone in her neck, but she'll be okay in the long run. Iggy, when I saw him that time in the hospital waiting, he was chewing a hole right through his beard, he was so worried, and it made me think he wasn't such a bad dude after all. It all goes to show, like Grim says, that you can't always judge a book by the cover. It turns out to be a pretty weird Christmas vacation, as you might imagine, and Graham keeps fussing at me and won't let me sleep in the cellar. I don't care if he is under lock and key, she says. Grim, he says, please humor the woman. She's worried about to death. And so I sleep upstairs on the fold-out, and at night Graham keeps checking to see I'm there, which is a pain, but she can't help herself, and anyhow, I'm just as glad not to be alone in the down-under. Freak, well, the fair Gwen just about threw a fit when she got him home, because of him disobeying a direct order and sneaking away to rescue me. But after a while, she calms down, and all she does is just look at him and shake her head. What am I gonna do with you? She asks. Put me up for adoption, he says. I want to go live with the Waltons. He means the TV show that keeps repeating, and of course he's teasing her, but the fair Gwen is not amused. No more crazy adventures or dangerous quests, young man. You have to be careful, she keeps saying, extra careful. She means the trouble he has sometimes catching his breath, because of the way his insides keep growing, faster than his outside, which hasn't really grown at all. Freak goes into the medical research place every few months now, which, he says, is a real pain, not that it actually hurts. Dr. Spivak says, my unique status as a marble of genetic aberration makes me an object of intense curiosity, he says in that lofty way of his. Specialists from the world over are familiar with my case. What about the secret operation, I ask, when the fair Gwen can't hear us? The one where you'll get a robot body. Freak has this very cool, scientific look on his face, and he always says the same thing. The bionic research continues, my friend. The work goes on. I don't know why I keep asking, because it gives me the creeps. You'd think I could be as cool as Freak about the idea, because it's him that's going to get a new bionic body. But just thinking about it makes me want to jump up and run around. I keep telling Graham that when Freak is in the hospital, for his tests, I shouldn't have to go to school because we're like a team, but she won't buy it. I know Kevin has been a great help to you, she says, but you've got a brain of your own, haven't you, dear? Yeah, right. The other thing about school that's different after Christmas vacation is how jealous everybody is that we got our pictures in the paper and on the local TV. Mrs. Donnelly in English calls us the dynamic duo, and she put a cut-out picture from the paper up on the bulletin board. Wouldn't you know, some goon put mustaches on us the very first day. Freak says he looks cool with a mustache, and he can't wait to grow one, and he makes Mrs. Donnelly leave the picture up. Me, I'd just as soon forget about the whole thing. I really hate the idea of having to testify in a trial and tell what really happened. But everybody says I have to, if I want him locked up for the rest of his life. Which I do, especially after what he tried to do to poor Loretta, who was only trying to help. They can't make you do it if you don't want to, Freak says. His son doesn't have to testify against his father. Grim thinks it will do me good. Plus, he's really worried he'll get off again, or fool the jury by quoting from the Bible. Grim worries too much, Freak says. Everybody worries too much. The way it finally turns out with Killer Kane, Freak is right. Because just before the trial is supposed to start, and I've got my fingernails chewed down to the second knuckle, Grim gets this telephone call that makes him punch his fist in the air and go, "Yes, yes!" What happened? They made a deal, and Killer Kane pled guilty. Which means he has to serve out the rest of his original sentence, plus 10 more years. He'll be an old man when he gets out, Grim says. He'll be older than me. That should make me happy, but instead I feel really weird and worried. And Grim, who still thinks he knows everything, says I just have to get used to the idea. The man is an accident of nature, he says. All you got from him is your looks and your size. You got your mother's heart, and that's what counts. The weird thing I keep thinking about, what if something happens when I get older and I turn out to be another accident of nature? Grim sees me thinking about that one night, just before bed, and he sits on the end of the fold-out, and he says, "Things will make a lot more sense when you finish growing up, Maxwell. Now sleep tight, and don't let the bed bugs bite." Grim means well, I know that, but sometimes he says the numbest things, because it's growing up that worries me. Chapter 22. Remembering is just an invention of the mind. Spring has sprung, Freak says, and so are we. This is the day school gets out, and we're taking the long way home. By now, I've been carrying him around on my shoulders for almost a year. We call it walking high, and even if we haven't been going on any dangerous quests lately, so the fair Gwen won't have to throw a fit, Freak hasn't exactly given up on slaying dragons. "The world is really and truly green all over," he says. "Do you remember what it used to be like back in the Ice Age, when the glaciers covered the earth and the saber-toothed tiger roamed the frozen night?" No, I say. "How could I remember that? I wasn't even born." "Don't be a pinhead," he says. "Remembering is just an invention of the mind." I go, "What's that supposed to mean?" "It means that if you want to, you can remember anything, whether it happened or not. Like I can remember what it was like in the Ice Age. I kept trying to invent stuff. The wheel, central heating, indoor plumbing. But the Neanderthals were happy with just a campfire and a fur coat." If you guess that Freak has been reading a book about the Ice Age, you're right. He's been seeing a saber-toothed tiger behind every bush. Except that so far, all of them have turned out to be stray cats. Or once it was this skunk, and it's a good thing I can run fast, or we'd have to soak in tomato juice, which is the only way to get rid of the stink. "Inventing electricity would be tough," he says, "without copper wire and magnets, but I could handle inventing a compass. All you have to do is rub the needle. That way, everybody could head south and get away from the glaciers." "First, you need to invent a time machine," I say, "so you can go back there and give all the cavemen a hard time about indoor plumbing." Freak goes, "You don't need a time machine if you know how to remember." Which is something I'll always remember, him saying that and me trying to figure it out. Freak's birthday is a couple of days after school gets out, and the fair Gwen has already made it clear he's not getting a ride on the space shuttle. 13 is supposed to be extra special, he says. "The least you could do is get my name on the list. Or how about a linear accelerator, just a small one so I can split a few atoms?" The fair Gwen goes, "I suppose this means you're going to be an obnoxious teenager." The deal is, this is really two birthdays for the price of one, because Freak the Mighty is almost a year old. "Talk about a prodigy," Freak says. 1 year old, and already he's on his way to 9th grade. The fair Gwen just rolls her eyes when we talk like that. Freak says we can't expect her to understand, because you can't really get what it means to be Freak the Mighty unless you are Freak the Mighty. Anyhow, the party is just a family affair, because Freak isn't supposed to get overexcited, which is like saying the moon isn't supposed to go around the earth. "Last year I got the ornithopter," he says. "This year, why not a helicopter? A real one, though. You can't expect a teenager to play with toys." "Why not a jet plane?" the fair Gwen says. "Cool," Freak says. "A Learjet." What he's really getting, and I've been sworn to secrecy, is this new computer, the one he's been drooling over in his computer magazines. It comes with a modem, which means if he has to stay home for some reason, he can go to school over the telephone. The idea is I'd be there in the classroom with a matching computer. The only problem, I don't know squid about computers. You'll learn, the fair Gwen says. Kevin will teach you. But why would he have to stay home? I ask her. We're out in the kitchen, and she and Graham are frosting the cakes, and Freak is hanging out in the living room, acting like he intends to have a party every day for the rest of his life. Maybe he won't have to stay home, the fair Gwen says, and she and Graham kind of lock eyeballs for a second. That secret code that mothers have. This is just in case, Max. I think maybe he's already guessed about the computer, I say. That's why he's jerking your chain about the space shuttle ride and Learjets. I'm not surprised, the fair Gwen says. You can't keep anything from Kevin. Freak hardly touches his supper. He says he's saving his appetite for the cake. And finally, we're all done eating, except for Grim, who keeps rubbing his belly and rolling his eyes and telling the fair Gwen what a genius she is with fresh peas and new potatoes and salmon. And he'll have just a smidgen more, thanks, until finally Graham clears a throat and smiles, and Grim has to apologize for being such a pig. The funny thing is, when at last they do bring out the cake, Freak asks me to flame out the candles while he makes the wish. And then he doesn't even touch his piece. He just sort of pushes it around the plate. I figure he's so excited about getting the new computer that he's lost his appetite. Not that he's letting on he doesn't feel good. He's acting just as wise and smart-mouthed as ever. I should have asked for earplugs, he says, when we're done singing Happy Birthday. You better check the glassware for cracks. Hush up, the fair Gwen says, or we'll give you another chorus. When she brings out the computer, he acts so surprised and happy. Maybe he really is surprised. Right away, he wants to turn it on and show off what a brain he is. And because it's his birthday, we all have to sit there and admire him and go, amazing and fantastic. And Kevin, how did you know that? And so on. He's showing Grim how to play 3D chess, and just watching that makes me dizzy. So after a while, I go out to the kitchen and help clean up, which is something I'm good at. Maxwell never breaks a dish, Graham is saying. He's very sure-handed for someone so large. We're almost done putting stuff away and wiping the counter when Grim shouts from the other room. All he says is, Kevin, but we can tell right away that something is wrong. We run in, and Freak is leaning back in his chair, making this wheezing sound, panting real fast, and his eyelids are flickering. He's having a seizure, Grim says. Call an ambulance. The fair Gwen is already on the phone. I run out in the street and start waving my arms and jumping up and down so they'll know where to stop. And I keep running back in the house to check on things. But the fair Gwen says there's nothing we can do except wait. Chapter 23, The Empty Book. They won't let me visit him the first day. And Graham says I'll just have to be patient and let the doctors do their business. But I can't stand just sitting around, so I decide to walk over to the hospital, which Grim says is miles and miles, but suit myself. I know how to get there, because Freak and I went yonder that way once, so he could show me the medical research building. It's not the same, though, without Freak along to turn the houses into castles and the swimming pools into moats. All I keep thinking is, what a jip it is to have to go into the hospital on your birthday. Finally, I get there, and I see the fair Gwen's car in the visitor's parking lot. But Grim says I should leave her alone and let her tend to her son. So what I do is go around back to the medical research building and find the stupid little tree I can sit under. I have that old ornithopter bird with me, and I'm winding it up and flying it around, figuring maybe Freak would get a chance to look out the window and see it flittering by. That's my plan. And I'm under that puny little tree, messing with the bird, until this guy mowing the lawn makes me move. So I wander around to the front of the hospital, and that's when the fair Gwen finds me. Maxwell, she says, and she gives me this great big hug. A wet hug, because she's been crying. Max, we've been looking all over for you. Kevin wants to see you. He's making quite a fuss about it, and Dr. Spivak says it's okay, but just for a few minutes. So the fair Gwen takes me inside, and I figure we're heading for the medical research building. But instead, we go into the regular hospital. He's in the ICU, she says. So they're taking really good care of him? They're doing their best, Max, she says. The intensive care unit is this place where there are so many nurses you can't hardly turn around without bumping into one, which I do as soon as we get there. Every patient gets a room alone, and there's all this electronic gear the fair Gwen says is called telemetry, which means when Freak sneezes, the nurses know about it before he can wipe his nose. I'm not scared at all until I actually go into his room and see how small he looks on the bed. They've got him sitting up with all these tubes going into his arms and up his nose, and Dr. Spivak is guarding him. She won't let me come too close. I thought no visitors was the best policy for now, Dr. Spivak says, but what Kevin wants, Kevin gets. Dr. Spivak is a small woman with short red hair and a real stern face, and it's like she's mad because Freak wants to see me, or because I'll break some of her precious equipment. That will be all, Freak says to her. You are dismissed. The thing is, his voice sounds funny. Not just faint and weak, but kind of whistly. Only when I get closer do I see he's got this weird little plastic button stuck in his neck. It's called a tracheotomy, he says, holding his finger against the button, which stops the whistling noise. Standard procedure to facilitate breathing. Does it hurt? No way, he says. I think it's cool. Listen to this. Then he plays with his finger against the button, making his throat whistle a tune, which he says is a theme from Star Trek, although you can hardly recognize it. So when do you come home? I ask. Freak can't move much the way they've got him set up in the bed, so he sort of shakes his eyes instead of his head. I'm not coming home, he says. Not in my present manifestation. I go, what? The bionic unit is on red alert, he says. Tonight they'll take me down there for my special operation. The next time you see me, I'll be new and improved. I'm scared, I say. Don't be a moron, he says. You're not the one having surgery. I still wish they wouldn't. Don't argue with me, he says. I have to lean close to hear him because his voice is so small and whispery. He goes, if you argue with me, I'll get upset, and they can tell in the telemetry. Then you'll get in trouble. So I just stand there, like a lump, and don't say anything for a while. I put the ornithopter on the foot of the bed, but I don't think he notices. See that book on the table? He asks. He can't point, but I see the book on the table. Open it, he says. The book reminds me of the dictionary he gave me for Christmas, except when I open it, all the pages are blank. That's for you, he says. I want you to fill it up with our adventures. Huh? Write it down, dummy. I was going to do it, but now it looks like I'll be busy getting used to my new bionic body. It'll probably take me weeks just learning how to walk with long legs. I put the book down. You're the one with the brain, I say. I'm the long legs. Don't get me upset, he warns. I won't have the time, so you'll have to do it. Just write it all down, like you're talking. Put in all the fun we had. The cool things we did. Our adventures. But you know I can't write, Kevin. It's all in your head, Max. Everything you can remember. Just tell the story of Freak the Mighty. No big deal. I pick the book back up, but I don't say anything more about how hopeless it is. Me trying to write stuff down, because I don't want to set off the telemetry. He does that himself about a minute later when he starts to cough, and before I can say anything, the room is swarming with nurses, and Dr. Spivak is telling me I have to leave. Out this second, young man, and let us do our jobs. They let me wait outside the ICU with the fair Gwen, who is just standing there at the window, wringing her hands and not saying anything. And then finally they come out and say he's okay. It was just a bad spell, that they have him stabilized. A while later, Graham comes into the hospital, and she drives me home. Nobody talks much at supper that night, except when Grim opens his big mouth and says, poor Gwen looks like she's in terrible pain. I go, poor Gwen? She's not the one having the special operation. Grim and Graham just look at each other like they can't believe I'm so dumb. And finally Graham says, Maxwell, dear, make an effort to eat your vegetables. That night, I put the empty book in the pyramid box for safekeeping and for good luck. Chapter 24, The Return of Kicker. The deal is, I'm not supposed to bother anybody at the hospital. Yeah, right. Like me being there is going to screw things up. The way everybody is acting around here, you're supposed to shut up and not do anything but wait, which makes me crazy. So early the next morning, when Grim is still snoring loud enough to rattle the window panes, I get up and sneak out of the house. The way I figure, I can check on Freak and be back in time for breakfast. No harm done. It doesn't work out like that, to say the least. The sun is just coming up over the mill pond, and there's a spooky mist on the water. You can hear all the frogs making a racket under the lily pads, and the mosquitoes sound like bullets whizzing by, and I have to kind of slap and run until I get clear of the smelly old pond. Moving fast, like the sun is chasing my heels, I'm running down this long, faint shadow of me that stretches out ahead. You can't ever catch up with it. I'm thinking with my feet, like the rest of me is still asleep. Not that I'm completely alone. There's just one old guy. He's actually out cutting his lawn. He's got these headlights rigged up on his rider mower, and he's wearing pajamas, too. Like it's normal, everybody does it. When I get to the hospital, the streetlights are just starting to click off. The lobby is empty, and there's nobody at the desk to tell me I can't be visiting patients at the crack of dawn. There are plenty of nurses in the ICU, though, and they see me coming. This one woman runs right out from behind the telemetry station, and she's got her hands up to her mouth, and I'm pretty sure she's trying to shush me, even though I'm not making any noise. She's not telling me to be quiet, though. She's saying, "Oh my God, you must be Maxwell." Even though she's never seen me before in her life. I go, "Is Kevin back yet?" Oh dear, she says. "Is he going to be okay?" Oh dear, she says, oh dear. Now, more nurses are coming out of the ICU. One of them is the one I accidentally bumped into yesterday, and when she sees me, she goes, "Better page Dr. Spivak. Kevin was her patient." That's when I notice that some of the nurses are crying and looking at me strange, and all of a sudden, I just go nuts. Just go nuts. I'm saying, "No way, no way," and this nurse is trying to throw a hug on me, and I push her away. Then I'm running down the hall, and it's like I'm Kicker again, ready to just blast anybody who dares touch me, and I have to keep running. I'm skinning around the corners and bumping into walls, and no one can touch me, even if they're brave enough to try. I just keep running and running until I get to these glass doors that say medical research. The doors are locked, and it's dark inside. Behind me, people are shouting to call the guards, and I punch my hand right through the glass, and I'm inside, skidding over broken glass through the dark, and I keep going until I come to this other set of doors. No admittance. No glass this time. They're solid, so I can't punch through. And I'm kicking and kicking and slamming into the doors, and that's when all the hospital cops catch up with me. A bunch of them jump on me, and I keep going, running around in circles like an accident of nature, until finally there's so many of them on me, I can't stand up anymore. They're putting handcuffs on my wrists and my ankles, and they're sitting on me and going, "We'll have to medicate him." And this one cop says, "With what, an elephant gun?" That's how Dr. Spivak finds me, covered with cops. She's his worried face leaning down. Her eyes are red and blurry, and she's saying, "I'm sorry, Maxwell. We did our best. Better let me bandage up that hand. You're bleeding." "He believed you," I say. "You said you could give him a new body, and he believed you." "What are you talking about?" "The special operation," I say. "The bionics unit." Dr. Spivak makes the cops let me up and says she'll be responsible. But they leave the handcuffs on me, just in case. And the cop who was talking about needing an elephant gun has this nightstick out, and he's ready to bop me if I make a move. Dr. Spivak sighs and says, "Somebody get me a coffee, please." And then she looks at me and goes, "You'd better tell me all about it." So while she's bandaging up my hand, I tell her about how Freak has been coming to the medical research lab every few months to get fitted for his new bionic body. And Dr. Spivak's face goes soft, and she nods to herself and says, "Well, that explains it." "It was all a lie, wasn't it?" I say. "You were just telling him that so he wouldn't be scared." "You know better than that, Maxwell. You couldn't lie to Kevin. I tried a little fib on him when he was about 7 years old because I didn't think a child could handle the whole truth. And you know what he did? He looked his disease up in a medical dictionary." That's when I know she's telling the truth. Freak and his dictionary. Kevin knew from a very young age that he wasn't going to have a very long life, she says. He knew it was just a matter of time. So he was lying about getting a robot body? Dr. Spivak is shaking her head. "I don't think it was a lie, Maxwell. Do you? I think he needed something to hope for, and so he invented this rather remarkable fantasy you describe. Everybody needs something to hope for." "Don't call it a lie. Kevin wasn't a liar." "No," I say. "But what happened to him, really?" "I could tell you all the medical terminology," she says, but what finally happened is his heart just got too big for his body. There was talk about arresting me for busting up the hospital. The cop with the nightstick was in favor, but finally they released me into the custody of Grimm. On the way home, he goes, "Do you want to talk about it?" "Just leave me alone," I say. "You got it," he says. Chapter 25. What Loretta Said. That was a year ago. I hid in the Down Under for days and days and kept the door closed, which is why I missed the funeral and the Fair Gwen going away. Graham told me about it afterwards, how she couldn't stand to live in the house with Kevin gone, and who could blame her. Grimm threatened to unscrew my bedroom door, but he never did. He just kept saying I should come out for Graham's sake, and sometimes she'd come down and say I should come out for Grimm's sake, and so on and so forth, until finally I gave up and came out. I don't know if this makes sense, but for a long time I felt like I was a balloon and somebody had let the air out of me. I didn't care if I ever got the air back, because what does it really matter if we're all going to die in the end? That's how down I was feeling, and sorry for myself. Grimm tried to tell me, it isn't how long you've got that matters, it's what you do with the time you have. But that sounded so lame and puny next to Freak dying that I just didn't want to hear it. This one day, just before school was supposed to start, I was moping around the backyard and thinking again how pointless and stupid everything was, and Grimm comes over and says, "You know what? Most of us go all the way through life, and we never have a friend like Kevin. So maybe you should count yourself lucky." "Yeah, right," I say. "Suit yourself," he says. "But let's get one thing straight. You're going back to school if I have to hitch a rope to the bumper and drag you there. Is that clear?" So I went and hated every minute of it, and I especially hated how people kept feeling sorry for me, as if it was me who died. Finally, one time, even Tony D came up to me and said it was a shame what happened, and I could see that he really meant it. And I just blew up and told him if he ever felt sorry for me again, I'd put him headfirst into the mill pond and pound him down into the mud like a fence post, so we're enemies again, which is just the way I like it. Not too long after that, this was winter by then, I saw Loretta Lee in the street. She still had on the neck brace, and you could smell booze on her breath. But what do you expect? A miracle? Just because she lost her head and acted good for a couple of minutes? Anyhow, Loretta sees me, and she says, "Did you hear about Gwen? She's in California, and she's got a new boyfriend. His name is Rick, and they're crazy about each other. Ain't that good news?" "I guess so." "Take it from me," she says, "it is. So what are you doing these days?" "Nothing." She gives me this long look, and she goes, "Nothing is a drag, kid. Think about it." I thought about it all the way home. That night, I pulled the pyramid box from under the bed and got the empty book out of the pyramid, and I'm thinking, who are you kidding, Maxwell Cain? You haven't got a brain. And that's the truth, the whole truth, the unvanquished truth, is how Freak would say it. So I wrote the unvanquished truth stuff down and then kept on going for months and months until it was spring again and the world was really and truly green all over. By the time we got here, which I guess should be the end, I'm feeling okay about remembering things. And now that I've written a book, who knows? I might even read a few. No big deal. Freak's Dictionary. A. Aardvark, a silly-looking creature that eats ants. Arg, what the aardvark says when it eats ants. Abacus, a finger-powered computer. Abscissa, the horizontal truth. Algorithm, math with a rock and rock beat. Alimentary, what Sherlock Holmes said to Dr. Watson about where the food disappeared. Allegory, a peculiar kind of story that's often pretty gory. Archetype, what Max sees when he dreams of architects. Arithmetic, inventing with numbers. Armor, a robot-like suit worn by knights of old. B. Big lie, ignorance is bliss. Bionic, a way to improve on the human condition. Bloviate, to expel hot air in the form of words. Boats, shoes big enough to fit Maxwell Cain. Book, a four-letter word for truth serum. Brain, a muscle that improves with exercise. Butthead, one who can sneeze a hot dog through his nose. C. Camouflage, how a camel blends into the desert. Cigarette, something that should be obscene, not smoked. Copacetic, the Faraguan's word for everything is cool. Cretin, another name for blade. Critters, small, irritating children, also known as rugrats. D. Demeanor. The meaner your face, the worse your demeanor. Dictionary. A source of knowledge, fun, and rude jokes. Down Under. A land far away in Maxwell's basement. Dyad. Another word for Max and Kevin. Dyne. Unit of energy to move a gram 1 centimeter per second per second. E. Edification. Education that tastes good. Erg. A measure of energy equal to 1 dyne per centimeter. Excalibur. A sword with magic powers. F. Fealty. Loyalty with an F. Folderol. Grimm's word for nonsense. Food. Fuel for humans, preferably so-called junk or UFO. Foozle. To make a stupid mistake. Fornax. A cool-sounding constellation. Formicidae, a type of insect never found in Kevin's pants. Fur ferocious, covered with dandruff. G. Gadzooks, what Grimm says when surprised. Galahad, son of Lancelot, finder of the Holy Grail. Goon, a four-letter word for Max in a bad mood. Graham, a sweet lady of light. Grimm, a gentleman of the old school, before they tore it down. Gruel, whatever you want more of. H. Haberdasher, a person who chases after wind-blown hats. Haiku, versification, by the quantum mechanic means numberless sum. Hammerhead, a know-it-all. Her story, the past from a female point of view. Hieroglyphics, Max's handwriting. History, the past from the male point of view. Holus bolus, all at once. Human, an improbable, imperfect creature. I. Iapetus, a cool-sounding moon that orbits Saturn. Icarus, a high flyer, as in, to do an Icarus. Ichthyology, the study of icky foods, for instance, fish. Idea, a seed you plant in your head. Igneous, too hot to eat. Incandescent, an excellent idea. Intergalactic, out of this world. J. Jabberwocky, the language of Jabba the Hutt. Jillian, millions and millions. Jitterbug, a nervous cockroach. Jocular, amusingly athletic. Jocularity, a joke made by a jock. Joule, a measure of energy equal to 10 million ergs. Jurassic, cool, excellent, what the Faraguan calls far out. K. Kazoo, a place where weird-sounding musical instruments are kept in cages. Kevin, a unit of measurement equal to 70 centimeters. Kinetics, the study of small families. Night, rhymes with bright and fight and right. Kong, another word for falling down. L. Lacrimation, an emotional display to be avoided. Lagoon, a French gangster. Lancelot, King Arthur's bravest knight. Lexicography, what Webster invented, Kevin perfected. Library, where they keep the truth serum and the magic carpets. Liftoff, what happens when you open a book. Limerick, a mighty dude called Max saved his pal from bad attacks, and they conquered the world with banner unfurled and time left over for snacks. M. Magnesium, the white sparkles in skyrockets. Massives, fatheads who assume that television tells the truth. Math, you have nothing to fear but math itself. Max, a unit of measurement equal to 190 centimeters and still growing. Megapod, Max's shoe size. Midget, a word used by people with small minds. Muciferous, any disgusting food, as in muciferous tapioca. N. Nanosecond, 1/1,000,000,000 of a second. Neanderthals, what we all were before plumbing was invented. Nicotine, a toxic waste of time. Nonillion, millions of septillions. O. Obfuscate, a needlessly confusing word for needlessly confusing. Obstinate, Kevin when he knows he's right. Odoriferous, sneaker perfume. Olfactory, where they manufacture smells. Ornithopter, a big word for a mechanical bird. P. Percival, a knight who saw the Holy Grail. Physics, what matters to energy? Postulate, when you presume to assume. Potassium chlorate, the womp in the skyrocket. Potassium nitrate, the bang in the skyrocket. Primordial, the good old days. Primordial ooze, boring conversation about the good old days. Q. Quadrillion, more than a billion, less than quintillion. Quantic, more than enough, as in quantic amounts of carats. Quantum, imaginary sums of impossible numbers. Quest, an adventure in which you have to use your imagination. Quintillion, more than a quadrillion, less than septillion. R. Reading, beaming up into books. Relativity, the study of mysterious relatives. Robotics, the science of designing and building robots. Robot, a mechanical entity, sometimes endowed with human characteristics. Round table, where King Arthur passes out the snack food. S. Sauropod, a vegan. Seismic, so exciting it makes you vibrate. Septillion, billions of billions. Spastic, how the fair Gwen gets when she's nervous. Strontium nitrate, the blue in a skyrocket. T. Telemetry, how to make nurses jump every time you sneeze. Television, the opiate of the masses. Tellurian, another word for earthling. Time machine, your imagination. Tracheotomy, a unique method of whistling the Star Trek theme. Troglodyte, one who hates books. Tubaliferous, splendid, close to perfect. U. Ufology, see under food, the study of the unidentified flying objects. Unicorn, a horse who makes a point. V. Vamoose, what you say to a moose when you want it to leave. Vanquish, to defeat in battle, preferably with dragons. Vegan, a human sauropod. Viscous, a thick, viscous liquid. W. Watt, a measure of electricity equal to 1 joule per second. Writing, talking on paper. X. Xyloid, another word for blockhead. Y. Yonder, a place that lies over the next horizon. Z. Zag, what you do after you zig. Z, a Z in England. Zest, the zing in an orange. Zig, what you do before you zag. Zing, what you taste when you bite into an orange. Zit, adolescent eruption, not to be confused with teenage volcano. Zoo, an 8th grade English class.
We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged listening library production. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 1993 by Rodman Philbrick. Production copyright 1998, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.
Hello, this is Jim Dale, narrator of the Harry Potter audiobook series. Listening to audiobooks isn't just great entertainment, it's also a great way for your family to experience and enjoy books together. Studies have shown that listening to stories read aloud helps children build vocabulary, improve their reading skills, and succeed more readily in school. It's an important step on the road to becoming a good reader, and one of the best ways to help ensure a lifelong love of literature for the children you care about. Check your local retailer for the wide selection of audiobooks available from Listening Library. Or if you would like to visit us online for more information, check our website at www.listeninglibrary.com. Thank you, and happy listening.